This reading is from Richard Rose's Albigen Papers, the fourth paper, on gurus and unique systems. Magic. The world of magic comes under the first of the systems, those which use mechanical means. This is not a field to be ridiculed because it seems to be rooted in things tangible or materialistic. Under the many categories of magic, we find scientific results once the unknown processes are understood. Hypnosis and mesmerism were once in the province of magic, but there is no better lever than hypnosis to understand the human mind. The herb of the medicine man often becomes the life-saving drug for those who ridiculed the medicine man. Much magic is rooted in intuitional procedures, so completely intuitional that there would be no logical way to explain the rituals that are used to bring about predicted results. We might say that magic is in many cases the science or ability that goes directly to nature for the understanding of nature, rather than an aloof, perhaps impossible, appraisal with rubber gloves and scalpel. Magic has one great stumbling block. It becomes an endless trip to fantasy land. And many so-called discoveries of deeper magic have never been properly explained. Let us take some of the cases. Benvenuto Cellini relates one in his autobiography. The priest was able to bring up, literally, legions of demons. It is difficult to believe that the priest would be interested in gold alone, and that Cellini would be interested in seduction alone. There seemed to be no great interest into the nature and origin of these things. All we know about them is that they were very powerful, that they, or at least the speaker among them, liked virgin boys, and that all of them had an aversion for Essa Fotida. Eliphas Levi, perhaps the foremost author on magic, leads us to believe that magic may well be the utilization of mechanical levers to facilitate mental creativity. It is said that a lifetime of magical studies and exercises did not bring him happiness, and he supposedly rejoined the Catholic Church later in life. The life of Aleister Crowley is another instance of a very unhappy man. A life that began perhaps as an earnest drive into high magic soon became mixed with drugs and sex. His historians indicate that he degenerated quickly into a combination of nature worship and witchcraft. And to all appearances, most of the rituals were sex sessions stimulated by drugs. The magus should never allow himself to be absorbed into the experiment. We find magic to have been perhaps a factor in older religions that spelled for those religions permanence or transience. We find the Jews gaining power with the rod of Aaron, which ate the snakes from the rods of the Egyptians. We find the magic of the Apostle Peter frustrating the levitations of the magician Simon. Miracles come under the heading of magic, and we find that almost every major religion finds it necessary to list miracles performed by its members at one time or another. Miracles have been somehow accepted as the external form of divine contact on the part of the practitioner. If we were to remove the changing of the wine at the wedding feast, the raising of Lazarus, the feeding of the multitudes on insufficient bread and fish, and the casting out of devils, the message of love may never have gained the footing that it did, nor would Jesus have gained the stature of Savior. There are limitations to magic, however, and this fact or phase of magic has not properly been explained to the devout followers who imagine that the powers of the magician are without limits. A hint of the nature of Jesus' works of magic is given in the 13th chapter of Matthew, verses 53 to 58. The last verse there reads, "And he did not many mighty works there because of their unbelief." Jesus had gone back to his hometown to do a little preaching and met some skepticism. Miracles do not come entirely from a divine source, if at all. Even those miracles brought about with the aid of the faith of the believers of followers are subject to natural laws. The phenomena that are listed as miracles are mechanisms that do not upset any natural laws, but are rather natural phenomena, not just yet understood or explained by what we understand to be scientific explanations at the time. The question has often been raised concerning the reluctance or inability of Jesus to embarrass his enemies with magic at the time of the final agonies. It is argued that since he predicted his death, it would have been unwise for him to have escaped the enemy. But the fact that he predicted it may well mean that he recognized inexorable karma or natural laws that could not be breached. The argument has often been brought forth that his success in centuries to come depended upon the spectacle of ignominious self-sacrifice being imprinted upon the mind of man. Such a display was not necessary for Gautama the Buddha, and in fact, Gautama advised his followers against using magic. Let us suppose with justifiable supposition that the changing of the water into wine was done with hypnosis, that Lazarus was either hastily interred, an epileptic or hypnotized cataleptic, that the feeding of the multitudes was either hypnosis or sleight of hand, and that the casting out of devils was simply exorcism. Exorcism has been demonstrated by many primitive shamans since the time of Christ, these shamans being not even Christian converts, let alone priests. Every magician gathers belief about him like a snowball, and as the belief snowballs bigger and bigger, he is able to do more marvelous things. But as I said before, all the while the magician is dealing with a science of which he knows very little. He plays by ear, as it were, until one day he almost surely tries some trick that does not work. The factors which made his success vanish like a puff of smoke. These factors are his ever-inflating ego and the belief of the audience. The factors which we do not know and the ignorance of them brings about his failure. Some of the Magi have come to the conclusion that the visible world is an illusion. This can only be understood properly when viewed from the position or attitude of the Absolute. And this is saying little more to relative man than to assure him of a possible situation that cannot be proven. From the material standpoint, we cannot argue that the material, visible world is illusory. However, the magus presumes that proper knowledge of the nature of this illusion will somehow give him power over it. Those who have really experienced sentience of the Absolute and have viewed life from the direct appraisal of things lose all inclinations to change any part of the theatrical mental reflections. An adult simply loses interest in the toys of childhood, and it matters not who has the marbles now. The Kabbalah. I do not wish to deal extensively with the Kabbalah because I have encountered too many diverse authorities or pseudo-authorities on the basic value of the Kabbalah. There are evidently two uses of the Kabbalah. The lesser of these deals with magic, and the higher use is in the pursuit of wisdom. McGregor Mathers lists four forms of the Kabbalah. Practical Kabbalah, or that which is devoted to talismanic magic. The literal Kabbalah, or that which deals with a numerological analysis of the sacred word. Also the unwritten Kabbalah and the dogmatic Kabbalah. If you are not interested in talismanic magic or in playing with word numerology, but in the part that deals with man's relations to God and the universe, you will want to go on to the unwritten Kabbalah. The wisdom of the unwritten Kabbalah is transmitted orally, only. It is hinted by Mathers that this transmission is a very secret and arcane matter. The written Kabbalah, or dogmatic Kabbalah, is practically an endless study, especially if we are to launch into literal Kabbalah as well. If the great secrets are transmitted orally, I conclude that years might well be wasted in study, when a few words whispered into the ear will do the trick. We are again here faced with the negative aspect of a movement, which is secrecy. Discovery of which is always followed by the question, what are they hiding, an explosive fact or an embarrassing ignorance? Additional yoga comments. I would like to emit any evaluation of the various types of Hatha yoga, and if possible, ignore the 100 or so cults that have sprung up in this country whose only evident aim is to collect money and delude their supporters. I would like to presume that if the reader has read this far, he will be aware that I have no interest in any movement that does not honestly work toward the truth. I consider it foolish for those who work for power to subscribe to any power system that lack the functional wisdom for managing the power promised, or that failed to forewarn the student of all results of their actions. I would also like to avoid as much as possible the endless and confusing use of Indian terms. It is my belief that wisdom is not the property of one race alone, and hence it can be expressed in any language, if at all. I borrow some words from the Indian language, such as yoga and karma, because they are almost lay terms. While we are memorizing new symbols to understand a chapter, we might be reading an entire book. The same thought applies to Kabbalistic studies. Many seekers are overimpressed by Hindu terminology and lose their way through the woods by studying the trees. For instance, the word transmigration is easier to understand than the word samsara because, for one thing, the latter word is too often confused with samskara, which means karmic memory. There is much to learn from the various Hindu schools. India is split up into many religious factions, which made for competition and stimulation. India is situated close to Tibet, and Tibet has long been the living stronghold of occultism and transcendentalism. The prevalence of the God-man attitude, or theory of the evolution of man's soul toward godhood, encouraged Indians and Tibetans for centuries to continue the exploration of man. If we are to take the axiom directive seriously, first know thyself, then we must realize that the Orientals are far ahead of us. A theology that expects us to know the nature of God when we do not even know our own nature is manifestly absurd. If, on the other hand, the Orientals, like today's Westerners, have taken the man-God attitude up because of laziness and moral decay, or out of rebellion against the priestcraft and temple taxes, then they are no further along than us. The prevalent theme of nearly all yogic systems is the upward evolution of transmigration to a better state. Some go as far as to set their sights upon a particular zenith at which they aim, such as nirvana. In nearly all yogic systems, there is a noticeable absence of the worship of a deity. Graduation from the worship of a non-human deity is looked upon as a horrible step by mystics on the path of yoga. Ramakrishna supposedly worshipped the goddess Kali for some time until a monk came along and taught him to meditate upon his own spiritual centers. Thus, Ramakrishna is supposed to have found all within himself. In this case, the guru monk became more important than Kali. I have previously referred to the guru chain, a very significant mechanism for immortality. The cults. There are many cults flourishing today. Some promise an advantage for the applicant that is similar to mental yoga. I have a filing cabinet filled with papers from different brotherhoods, orders, and simply nameless gurus. I am indeed puzzled to understand or evaluate some of them for motives. Some do not have the circulation necessary to bring in any periodic flow of money. I had to conclude that this type of venture had to depend upon a big financial killing by a complete takeover of the finances of the inquirers. This practice is not unusual. The Radha Swami group, while not asking for money, instructed their followers to place all of their physical karma in the hands of the master. This placing of the whole being in the hands of the master would naturally endanger any bank account. I received certain documents through the mail from a man who inferred that he had membership in a brotherhood of universal dimensions and ancient origins. Questioned by me about seeming inconsistencies were answered with vague replies or confusing allusions to general ethical postulates. Some of the documents had interesting information in them, but nothing was in them that could not be found somewhere else. They were unique in their manner of presentation only. One clever document tried to demonstrate that wisdom was somehow dependent upon the proportional ability to purchase it. With that one, I called a halt. Another cult, professing to be reliquary of ancient wisdom, used the trick of mailing me a letter from Greece. It informed me that I would soon hear from one of their elders in California. Most of these cults protect themselves by initially confiding to the applicant that the rest of mankind is vulgar and unable to contain the powerful medicine which the cult is about to bestow. The next step is the swearing of the applicant to secrecy under pain of causing kinks in the cosmos or in his own convolutions if there is any divulgence of the profane. This manages to screen the operation. For this reason, secrecy itself has become something to look for if you are looking for indications of trickery. Secrecy appeals to many businessmen or prominent professional men because, to begin with, they are a bit ashamed to have their colleagues or drinking companions hear about their joining a cult. A person may also be very hungry for the truth, but still wish to check it out before sacrificing too many of his business contacts or risking social criticism. We should not be afraid of social criticism if we have the conviction that a search is necessary for finding. And the search is more important than the static membership in an organized religion. When there is a liability of hurting the feelings of our friends, it is advisable not to preach an unsure doctrine or cult, but there is quite a gap between discretion and total secrecy. In the days of the Inquisition or the Salem witch hunt, secrecy was a necessity, of course, for students of witchcraft. But too many cults have sworn their members to secrecy only to be proven fraudulent themselves. A man, now deceased, who was known to have spent his entire life looking for the truth, spent many of his valuable younger years in a movement operated by a man and his wife. This couple seemed very sincere and had written several books that showed no great inconsistencies. Their works did contain a considerable amount of unprovable concept building. My friend, who had gathered quite a bit of money as a result of inventions, had evidently contributed to this pair for a period of over 15 years. The couple was involved in a scandal, and some unsatisfied victim exposed them to the world. They were found to be drug addicts and prone to sexual excesses and abnormalities with quite a circle of co-conspirators. and in the event that these things seem inconsequential, the crime was really inconsistency. They had been preaching quite the opposite of that which they were practicing. Too many of us are led to acceptance of cults by our eagerness to accept strange terms. Many cults are nothing more than a slightly new twist to older speculative theosophies. We are enchanted, as neophytes, by the use of new exotic terms such as the word chakra. While one group of philosophers is desperately trying to establish understanding of the body that is visible and the mind that has evident relationship with that body, other people are inventing and designing systems, both intangible and vague, and elaborating on details with imaginative detailed charts. The latter do not bother to explain either their system or their charts thoroughly so that the viewer may clarify the system with his own personal experience outside of 20 or 30 years servitude to a cult. And the final frustration is that even those who profess to have seen chakras still have no better knowledge than ourselves about the post-mortem destiny of man, other than a vague belief in reincarnation. An analogy might be given. It is like giving a condemned man a tedious course in anatomy so that he will know the precise functioning of his nervous system when he experiences the gas chamber. The thing with which that condemned man is concerned is the condition in which he will be after he has breathed the gas and expired. This analogy reference takes into account the possibility that there might be such a thing as a chakra. There exists a very valid argument that applies to systems that purport to change our state of being or to sharpen our intuition or understanding. This same argument is used to justify a lesser or a venal cult. The argument is, of course, that proof of the claims of a discipline aimed at changing our state of being lies in the end result and cannot be demonstrated beforehand. I do not flatly accept this argument in either case. We still must make an effort to make prior evaluations, and it would appear that a developed intuition is our only alternative. Gurdjieff and Uspensky. In the Gurdjieff movement, we find refreshing lack of Oriental terminology. On the other hand, Gurdjieff has his own unique brand of confusion. To learn of Gurdjieff, you might read Uspensky's In Search of the Miraculous, in Rahm Landau's God is My Adventure. Kenneth Walker also wrote a book about Gurdjieff, Venture with Ideas, which was reviewed in Time magazine. The review in Time had little mention of Walker except to say that the latter believed Gurdjieff to be an outstanding philosopher-psychologist. Gurdjieff died in 1949 at the age of 77. Uspensky, his chief disciple, died 2 years before. The article depicts Gurdjieff as a gourmet and a shearer of sheep, or a confidence man. The author does credit him as being the container of a vast amount of knowledge. From reading all and everything, and from reading what I could that had been written by those close to Gurdjieff, I have come to believe that he fathered an interesting metaphysics and had an astute insight into psychology. Some of his followers lost faith in him and left his Fontainebleau retreat after Gurdjieff became injured in an automobile accident. He is supposed to have led them to believe that his system gave him control over accidents. I am much more interested in the way Uspensky deals with the Gurdjieffian philosophy. Uspensky presents more of a serious, methodical approach. The Gurdjieffian fanfare is lacking in Uspensky's explanation of the work. With Uspensky, we recognize that learning to think correctly is more important than concept building because the latter may lead to fantasy. Some psychoanalytical systems are good, therefore. The self-observing system that gives us something to do with our meditations besides just allowing the thoughts to wander. We must indeed observe ourselves first. Another very good point about the Ouspensky lectures is his insistence upon the school as a means for growth. The implication, a very valid one incidentally, is that man must have his fellow men even in the business of spiritual development. Gurdjieff has now been dead for 20 years and his movement is still alive, but some of the people who are giving lectures with a pretense of authority as Gurdjieffian heirs are either functioning under conjecture or inaccuracy because their movements are fanning out in all directions. I heard the lectures were being given at Virginia Beach a few years back and decided to make the trip. I sought out the lecturer. He was a young man of 25 years, if that. 20 minutes of conversation with him started me in a homeward direction without listening to any of his lecture. In a brash manner, he announced that he knew all there was to know about the movement. I protested that he was only in his 20s and could not have known Gurdjieff in his lifetime. The boy had a ready answer. He announced with the same blandness that he had quite a start on me since he had known Gurdjieff in his previous lifetime or incarnation. There are about a dozen pretenders to Gurdjieff's throne, and none of them flatters the memory of Gurdjieff. I had a particular encounter with one such self-appointed guru of the Gurdjieffian line. This encounter may serve to demonstrate the extreme caution that a person must exercise in order to choose not only a teacher, but each acquaintance or co-worker. This man came to me practically out of nowhere. He came unrecommended and unsolicited. This fellow did not write and get acquainted by mail before making his appearance, a custom required for those coming to the ashram. He made several flamboyant phone calls and had his disciple make one. He next sent a very wordy and flattering telegram and followed the telegram in person, accompanied by two men, one crippled and the other hirsute. I picked them up at the nearest train station and drove them some 40 miles. Their smell was an ordeal in itself. Had it not been that part of this smell was an alcoholic one, I might have excused their untidy condition as the result of traveling and poor accommodations. The leader was an oily, hairy man with a weak but cunning face. I listened to his tales about Gurdjieff for several days before I realized that he really knew no more about Gurdjieff than myself. And he was an unctuous name-dropper, and at first some of the ashram residents were impressed with him. Soon I noticed that the other residents of the ashram were leaving and new arrivals were dissuaded from staying. I also learned that he was running a confidence racket. When questioned, he did not deny it and claimed that Gurdjieff had certain sincere students whom he did not charge, but that Gurdjieff, like himself, had no qualms about fleecing the little old ladies. With an affable smile, he spread his hands and remarked that Gurdjieff extracted large sums from people because money was the only contribution that some people could make. This impostor, whom I shall call Mr. A, took a few pages from Gurdjieff's history that were to his liking. He consumed a quart of wine a day if he could get his hands on it for his low blood sugar. End quote. The crippled man was receiving a small pension, and I discovered that the other two were using and abusing the crippled man. Finally, the crippled man left. The younger companion, Mr. J.G., was a very clever disciple. He constantly sang the praises of his leader. He would drop little tidbits regarding the long wait he had to endure before his teacher answered any of his questions. They spoke nonchalantly about raising the dead, about curing with herbs, and about their common master who walked through walls. Then other little stories began to trickle out. They told of having a sort of commune in New York in a condemned building. The police evicted them. Mr. J.G. bragged that he had shot a policeman in San Francisco. In one city on the West Coast, Mr. A. had his followers carry him upon a horizontal cross upon which he stretched, dressed in sundry clerical vestments and wearing a crown. This travesty he considered to be very comic. He also told of serving 30 days in jail for contempt of court. I decided I had two impostors on my hands and possibly two extortionists, judging from the money that came to them through the mail. So I moved them out of the house and told them that they would have to leave the premises. They asked for permission to stay a few days in a house trailer until some important mail came, which they were expecting soon. I agreed, mainly because they did not argue about leaving. It was very close to Thanksgiving, and they asked me to meet the bus in town and pick up a young lady who was coming in from the south to spend the holidays with them. They had no car. I picked this visitor up late in the evening before Thanksgiving. Since neither of these men believed in work, there was no adequate fuel at the ashram, so I suggested that this girl stay in my house in town for the night. I found out that she was 16 years of age and that she knew many startling things about Mr. A and J.G. She told me she did not wish to come and visit them, but that she came out of fear of physical violence and black magical powers. She had met them in Colorado. J.G. had encouraged her and a group of hippies to join with Mr. A. This little colony was evicted from the area, and they began to hitchhike toward New York. When the group arrived in New York, it only consisted of the two men and this young girl. They immediately tried to put her to work as a prostitute, and when she resisted, they beat her and broke her nose. And yet, this same girl was ready to go back for more punishment. The girl's mother had been sending them large sums of money. When I talked to the mother by phone, she admitted that the money was sent out of fear. When I ordered the two to leave the trailer, they threatened me and burned the trailer completely as they left. This is the price that can be paid for being impractical or being slow and setting oneself up as an arbiter of people coming to stay and work at the noblest of undertakings. I believe that the only way to get anything from the Gurdjieffian system is to study the books by Uspensky and the other disciples. After having done quite a bit of research, I failed to find anything of a spiritual leader. That he had wide experience is true, and that he was also gifted with extraordinary common sense is also true. He comes in with a new approach. We do not have to listen to an interminable symbology of no worthwhile meaning. We do not have to memorize a foreign vocabulary to study Gurdjieff. Yet he says many of the same things that we could learn if we labored through Oriental philosophy and transcendentalism. Gurdjieff furnishes us with a system by which we can escape mechanicalness and find self-determination. He also proposes the school or brotherhood. He is one of the very few authors that emphasize that man is victimized by nature. The theory of Cal tells us the same story that Gurdjieff tells, but in a different way, about man's hopeless condition as a slave to nature. Gurdjieff also reaffirms the many are called but few are chosen line that relates to the percentages of people who have evolved sufficiently to desire to escape or search for an answer. Gurdjieff categorizes the evolvement of man as having seven steps and claims that most of mankind falls into the first three steps or numbers. Thus, man number four is the one most likely to escape from the net of nature. Gurdjieff also places significance upon that which he calls the sly man. This little reference that we find in the Gurdjieff teachings is often overlooked. It has significant meaning. It means that we do not get to heaven by being saintly, because trying to be saintly is a fool's endeavor. A fool who pretends to envision the will of some invisible deity and to judge that that deity sees mankind acceptable if sweet and gregarious. Likewise, in ancient times, the same class of fools butchered human sacrifices because they thought the act of sacrifice to be pleasing to the gods. The Gurdjieff system teaches that a man first have common sense and must discover the many, many ways in which each human being outwits himself about the most serious of subjects, self-identification and survival. It is worthwhile to note that if a man does not know the looker, there is little use of looking. The evidence, which has been brought back by lookers whose cognitive apparatus has not been checked out, is not very reliable. In fact, down through the ages, the masses have chosen to use their emotions and desires as eyes. The Gurdjieff system automatically places man as the field of study. This is nothing new either. There is a very ancient adage, first know thyself. The Gurdjieff teachings have some inconsistencies. Much of the writings consist of a complex cosmology, and this comes as a bit of extra padding if his system is designed to bring man into the exaltation of being fully awake. Knowledge of the universal cosmology has no value to us if we cannot utilize that knowledge in the direction of our own immortality. Also, we can only conclude that being awake in the fullest sense is synonymous with reaching the truth, capital T, in the fullest sense. And since Gurdjieff does not describe for us this ultimate goal, but recommends a path similar to the threefold directive of Buddha, we can only assume that the goal must be the same in any case. And if the goal of the Gurdjieff or Ouspensky system would be, even without their intention, cosmic consciousness, there would not be much use in categorizing cosmologically an illusory world. Unfortunately, neither Gurdjieff nor Ouspensky tries to describe the condition of the man who is fully awake. We do learn that man number 7 is more awake than man number 4, but a person almost gets the impression from the writings of both and from the lives of both that they were not sure about the state of being that might be expected from a man number 7. In other words, the goal is never really named. And for this reason, I have come to the conclusion that the Gurdjieff system is a good and worthy system for a person starting out on the path of self-liberation, but it is not complete. Perhaps there was a personal teaching that was not recordable because it would naturally differ in each student's case. If this latter supposition is true, then of course the Gurdjieff system would be more complete, but it would still leave us in the dark about the reasons for the complex cosmology which is part of the writings. I realize that many opinions have been given in this book and only a little information has been given as to the manner of collecting the information that must necessarily have led me to a strong opinion. When I was about 25 years of age, I began to meet other men who were of the same mind as myself about the search for truth. Since I do not have their permission, I will not identify them. Not that they would object to being known, perhaps, but they have grown families and children and grandchildren who may feel that such divulgence would not be compatible with a particular game of life that they might be playing. We were not many. The more faithful ones numbered 6 or 8. Then there were other contacts who knew of our interests, and these friends also supplied us with information and attended our meetings. We decided to prospect in separate environments for systems and for people who might know more than ourselves. In the early days of the search, we were afflicted with the Hunt the Guru system. We promised one another to learn all we could and then compare notes. Each of us joined different sects and became initiates of those sects which held initiation requisite to learning that which the sects claimed to be valuable, esoteric knowledge. Needless to say, on many occasions we were disappointed with the trivial offerings of most sects. In this manner, we learned as a group that which could not have been learned in 3 lifetimes by any of us alone. We became acquainted with the initiation rites of SRF and Radha Swami. We obtained heaps of Rosicrucian private lessons or mandami. One of our group was opened in the Subud movement. 2 others attended Latihan sessions. We made lone trips to investigate materializations, spiritualistic phenomena of all sorts, and individuals who had particularly unique talents. We visited witch doctors, priests, Protestant ministers, and fortune tellers. One member took time out to help set up a scientific research group, the Mind Science Foundation of San Antonio, endowed by Tom Slick. We worked with smaller psychic research groups whose investigations were along the lines of ESP, table tilting, and hypnosis. We subscribed to magazines that dealt with occult or transcendental matters and occasionally placed ads in them to contact people who might be sincere. We had several things in common besides ignorance and the admission of it. We agreed that moneyed cults, power and glory cults, and movements with excessive secrecy were not worth the bother. Of course, we argued among ourselves over the relative worth of some movements. I feel that the history of our search is secondary to our conclusions. The history of our diggings would include many movements and teachings not even discussed in this book. Some are not worth mentioning. Some were found to be created out of whole cloth, and a few of those mentioned in this book are not worth the following of one day. But they are examined here nevertheless to demonstrate the negative effect they have upon the minds of too many people. By the same token, there are individuals who were instrumental in either encouraging me to continue my work or who were directly helpful and who, beyond a doubt, held the rank of teacher, who will not be described here because their value was recognized only by their conversations and their manner of working. If any sort of bridge has been built by our collective labors, a picture of the bridge is more important than a portrait of ourselves. And still in this chapter devoted to observations of teachers and unique systems, I should admit that those who played possibly the most valuable role for the most part of us were not the teachers of any cult or well-known system, but were individuals largely unseen by the general public, whose real value to us was forever unknown to their next-door neighbors, employers, and associates. To give them justice would require a chapter or book for each of them, and to write less would leave the reader with fragmentary evidence or would give only the human picture of mistakes made and blind struggling. It might be interesting here to give a sort of summary conclusion of our group as regards the systems encountered. I am sure that nearly all of us would agree that systems that aid in becoming rather than learning are endorsed. The real science, we concur, is knowing the self, which we somehow sense is the door to reality. The observation of magic, the study and classification of phenomena is mostly an interesting divergence for the mind when it is too tired to do anything else. The study of phenomena and phenomenal men does us no good if we cannot relate that study to the better understanding of ourself, or at least formulate laws of phenomena by studying them. An example of one of the phenomenal men is Edgar Cayce. I made a trip to Virginia Beach to see his place and talk to some of the people who came there. I did it only as part of a family vacation. Edgar Cayce was dead, and his son Hugh Lynn manifested none of his father's psychic ability. And Edgar Cayce, while living, gave reams of advice and perhaps issued some semblance of a philosophy, but he left behind no system nor explanation of his own peculiar powers answerable to scientific investigation. Nor did he give a formula for a student who might like to be a psychic doctor or even finder of lost items. Cayce was a phenomenon, not a teacher. And now being gone, he is only a history of phenomenon. It is good to read of him and to read his writings. It is not wise to make of him a religion or a solitary path to truth. Phenomenal men are more valuable contacts than are phenomena. The study of phenomena includes the wide range of flying saucers, Fortean research, spiritualistic phenomena, magical mantras, astrology, numerology, and thaumaturgy. None of these deserves an all-out application of our life's energy, but they are more commendable pursuits than remaining inert on the soft bed of organized religion.